time for the Book Show on ABC Radio National, Ramona Koval with you. And having just celebrated his 81st birthday on Monday, Professor Harold Bloom, often named as the most influential literary critic in the world, is on the Book Show today to speak of his latest work, The Anatomy of Influence, Literature as a Way of Life. And for Harold Bloom, literature has indeed been part of almost every waking and sometimes even sleeping moment. Some of his 38 books include The Western Canon, Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, and the Book of Jay, as well as his pioneering study, The Anxiety of Influence, which appeared almost 40 years ago. The man who calls himself a bardolator for his devotion to the works of Shakespeare, and who pleads guilty to the charge of being an incessant canoniser, and yet regards himself as a common reader, joins us from his home in Connecticut, USA. Welcome to the Book Show, Harold Bloom.
Thank you very much, Ramona, dear.
Harold Bloom, you say when you were very young, freedom beckoned through the poets you first loved, and they gave you a sense of freedom. They conferred on you a real liberation. Can you talk a bit about that? What sort of freedom can a poet give
you?
Well,
I grew up in a loving but very poor household. I mean, by poor, not in terms of happiness. We were a devoted mother and father, and I was the last of five children. But I was born in the old East Bronx to a Yiddish-speaking family on July 11, 1930, in the height of the Great American Depression, and my father, though a skilled garment worker, was out of work. It was something of a struggle, and in a relatively small apartment, one did feel cooped up at times, and the streets of the East Bronx were frequently not very safe because, frankly, there was a Nazi organization, as it turned out, affiliated to Joe McWilliams and the Silver Shirts, who were all thrown into jail when the United States was attacked and by the Japanese on December 7, 1941, and subsequently declared war on Nazi Germany and fascist Italy also. But they used to go after us with baseball bats, and it was a rather harsh environment. But I started reading initially Yiddish poetry when I was about, I taught myself actually to read Yiddish, which I spoke anyway, of course. It was the mother tongue, the mama lushin for me, when I was about 3.5 or 4. And the earliest poetry I remember, and I still have it by heart, because then as now, I have a preternatural memory for poetry, and indeed sometimes for heightened prose, and an astonishing reading rate, which has never really changed. I started to read the Yiddish poets, in particular Yaakov Gluckstein, and my particular favorite, Moshe Leib Halpern. But then I taught myself, which is why my pronunciation has always been so idiosyncratic, I taught myself to read English when I was about 5.5, 6 years old, before I went off to kindergarten, where in fact they began to speak English around me and I heard it for the first time. I started reading poetry almost immediately, and among the earliest poets whom I remember were really rather simple ones, though beautiful, like A.E. Housman, some of the border ballads, and some Shakespearean songs. I gradually began to read Shakespeare. I still remember my first reading of Julius Caesar and of Macbeth, which terrified me. I must by then have been 8 or 9 or so. And then I went on to read Milton and discovered modern poetry. And then a very great moment for me, in some ways more determinating even than Shakespeare, was when at the age of 10 in the Melrose branch of the Bronx Library, where I'd been taken by my three older sisters, I opened the collected poems of Hart Crane and was utterly fascinated by the rhetoric and the vision and the whole glory of it, and fell in love with Crane's poetry. And for my, I took the book out incessantly from the Melrose branch, and at my request, for my 12th birthday, my oldest sister, Esther, who alas died recently, the last of my living siblings, she was, I would think, about 94 or 95, gave me, for my 12th birthday, the collected poems of Hart Crane, the earliest book I ever owned and still with me up in my study on the third floor of this huge old house where my wife and I have lived for half a century now out of our 53 years of marriage.
And the freedom that you tasted, what sort of freedom
the freedom, to use an old-fashioned term, but the only term really we have for it, of the capacious imagination, the Shakespearean imagination, but for me filtered through Hart Crane, who was intensely interested in Shakespeare, wrote a very fine sonnet to Shakespeare, who was obsessed with The Tempest, as I am now. There's a chapter on The Tempest in this Anatomy of Influence book. Freedom to suggest a sense of something ever more about to be. A sense, and these are highfalutin terms, but again, they're the only ones really available. A sense of possible sublimity, a sense of a larger cosmos than otherwise one could have hoped to know.
So this journey that you took as a young child through the Yiddish poets, through the English poets, through Shakespeare to Hart Crane about when you were about 12, was it a journey that you took on your own, or did someone take your hand?
No, I was an autodidact. I think I was pretty much self-taught all the way, indeed, through high school until at the age of 17, having won a special fellowship. I arrived at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York in September 1947 and immediately fell under the sway of a very great teacher. He was then 35, Maya Howard Abrams, M.H. Abrams, a very great scholar of Romanticism and of critical theory. Mike, as we all called him, Mike and I have been close friends now for, my heavens, I was 17 then. And Mike was 35. I am now, that's an 18-year difference. I am now 81, and Mike is going on 99 and is alive and healthy and lives in Ithaca, New York. And indeed, last year, at my request, came here to Yale and actually gave a poetry reading and then made brilliant comments on the poems, but he says he can't do that again. But if I, my dear, I'm still alive 18 years from now, I certainly will not be going off to another university to read poems aloud and comment upon them.
You never say never.
Oh, no, dear. I'm due to a series of somewhat debilitating mishaps and malaises, I walk with a cane and with some difficulty. One of my great sorrows, in fact, is that through the years, from an invitation from the great poet Alec Hope, A.D. Hope, so many years ago, down to overtures from my very dear friend John Kinsella. I remember Les Murray also once suggesting that I come to Australia, but alas, I never will get to Australia. It will always be for me what Hamlet calls the undiscovered country.
Well, you're very much across Australia right this moment because you're on ABC Radio National. We're speaking with Harold Bloom on The Book Show, and I'm Ramona Koval. So this idea of influence has been something that has been obsessing you or involving you all your life, in a sense. And the book, this one, is called The Anatomy of Influence. It's a revisiting a book called The Anxiety of Influence, which as I said, appeared about 40 years ago.
It was actually written before that in the summer of... Forgive me for interrupting you, Ramona, dear. In the summer of 1967, in fact, when I woke up on the morning of my 37th birthday in the same house here in New Haven, I'd had an awful nightmare in which some great winged cherub, a rather negative angel, and only gradually disentangled it and got rid of the Freudian overtones of it and began to see that it was... an image of what the prophet Ezekiel and then William Blake after him had called the covering cherub, or as the Hebrew text of Ezekiel says, the Haruf Mimshok, the far-extending cherub, the terrible angel with long, far-extending wings, Mimshok. And he was trying to stifle me. And I came down to breakfast with my wife, the same table that I'm sitting at now, and I said to her, Jean, I've had the most terrible nightmare. And she looked up from the Times that she was reading, the New York Times, and said, Harold, don't bring your nightmares to the breakfast table. So I brooded on that for a while and picked up. I've never learned to type even, and in the age of the computer, I'm more than ever a dinosaur. So I picked up what I use then as now, a Pentel Black Rolling Writer ballpoint pen and one of my endless big green ledger notebooks, and started to compose a kind of mad rhapsody called The Covering Cherub or Poetic Influence, a dithyramb, not even knowing what I was writing, a sort of wild kind of affair. And over many years, I gradually revised it to make some sense anyway, though some people would dispute that. And in January 1973, it and five other chapters and some interchapters and prose poems, and I don't know what else, were published as this rather wild, quite short little book by the Oxford University Press in New York called The Anxiety of Influence, A Theory of Poetry.
So you have puzzled over influence. I mean, I was wanting to know whether, you know, you're looking back at who or what was it about a certain poem or a certain piece of work that encouraged the next poet to write something different or write something in response to it?
I've had, as you know, Ramona, this really rather preternatural memory for really great poetry in particular. It just memorizes itself in me. Increasingly, though I think at first not quite consciously, but quite capaciously, I was gathering together on some level of apprehension the relationship of why one poem rather than another jostled the next poem in my head, and it became clearer and clearer to me as I wrote my early books, starting with a book published in January 1959 on Shelley, though that was mostly written back in 1954, originally as a Yale PhD dissertation, and going on through books on Blake and a commentary on Blake and the David Erdman definitive edition of Blake, which is still very much in print, and a book that's never gone out of print, the book for which I was best known for a long, long time, The Visionary Company, A Reading of English Romantic Poetry. I gradually came to realize, as I looked back on what I was doing, without making the hideous mistake of taking myself too seriously, which would always be a disaster, I've always said that I'm essentially a comic critic, and all I get are serious reviews and serious attacks. But I try to see at all times the comedy of poetic influence and the comedy of being an exegete on texts that are, though secular to me, sacred texts. There I seem to be emulating Yeats, and that reminds me that I went on, after several volumes of essays, to write a very large study of, just called Yeats, about his relationship to Blake and Shelley and romantic tradition in general. I think that came out in 1970 or so, and then I was hovering on the edge of the insight that led to The Anxiety of Influence, which was that poems, strong poems, are really creative misreadings of precursor texts. They can be imaginary precursors, they're usually composites, and The Anxiety, I used to quarrel with a later mentor, Norrie Frye, the great Northrop Frye of Toronto, author of The Fearful Symmetry, a wonderful study of William Blake, and of the, in his age, famous book called Anatomy of Criticism. I don't actually allude to that in my title. I'm thinking of the source for both Norrie and myself. Norrie, alas, is gone now. Burton's great Anatomy of Influence in the 17th century, a very wild and magnificent book. In the original manuscript of what is now published as The Anatomy of Influence, A Theory of Poetry, was about three times as large as it is now, but we are in an age where you can't really write enormous critical books anymore. I mean, I've done it in the past with books like Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, and a huge book called Genius, and some other works of that sort, but from now on, I think books have to be shorter, and I'm sure I'll never again write another book as long. I have a book coming out in September, also with the Yale Press, since it's the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, called The Shadow of a Great Rock, a literary appreciation of the King James Bible, but it's only 50,000 words, not counting quotations.
I was interested when I'm thinking about this. I'm wondering whether you are looking for poetic DNA or the origins of the poetic species.
Yes, I suppose, Ramona, that would be a valid metaphor for what I'm interested in.
So you charmingly insist that you are a common reader, even though you've had this marvellous autodidactic time until now. What makes you a common reader? What do you have in common with me or other readers who haven't been reading so deeply?
I have everything in common with you, Ramona, and with all readers throughout the world. I think my books in general now, and there are now actually 41 of them or so, have been translated into more than 40 languages, The Anxiety of Influence, more frequently even than the Western Canon book, another very large book. But The Anxiety of Influence has been translated into 33 or 35 languages. I can't keep count, and they don't always send me, including languages I simply cannot read, Albanian and Turkish and Farsi and so on. The phrase, of course, before Virginia Woolf, marvelous writer as she was, a marvelous literary critic, of course, popularized it, was invented by my great critical hero, Dr. Samuel Johnson, who said that it is by the judgments of the common reader that we must finally decide what is and what is not authentic high literature, which will survive and go on from one age to another and do some good. Johnson has always been my critical hero, in the sense that Shakespeare and Wallace Stevens and Yeats and Hart Crane and Milton and so many more, Chaucer, have been my poetic heroes. Johnson taught me, and I read Johnson again every week and have much of Johnson by heart. Johnson in The Lives of the Poets and his great edition of Shakespeare, this wonderful general introduction. Johnson says that the function of criticism is to transmute or convert opinion into knowledge. In my modest way, I tried to be Johnsonian.
This idea of you memorizing things and having things by heart, I read, of course, in the book that you, it was partly with all of these poems in your head clashing or echoing each other that made you think that they had images of the previous poems. It was partly that the repetition in your head.
I think that is true, probably to some degree, but also possession by a memory is a very crucial matter. I myself, since I go on teaching full time at Yale, I always give one undergrad. I've given up teaching graduate students because I'm alienated from all of these movements that have politicized criticism and from cultural politics of all kinds, which I simply can't abide, what I call the school of resentment, and I've characterized them as a rabblement of lemmings running down to drown themselves in the waters.
Are they still there, though? I mean, I thought that their time had passed, the postmodernists.
Well, I think I'm afraid I count the sort of sub-Marxists. I mean, I myself, as I've always said, I'm the true Marxist critic following Groucho Marx rather than Karl. And I stick with that still. My two great mottos as a critic, when they don't come from Dr. Johnson, come from Groucho Marx. One is, I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have me for a member. And the other is, whatever it is, I'm against it. and I think all critics, and critics should be common readers, and common readers in some sense have to be critics. But in any case, I always teach two seminars of a dozen undergraduates each, very carefully selected because there are so many applicants. And I try to be fair, but I also want people who I think will benefit most by it. And one discussion group is always in Shakespeare, and the other is in how to read poems. And I have the students, the normal procedure I've followed, and I've worked it out through the years, and it works perfectly now, I think. For one thing, it makes me shut up, and I have a tendency to talk too much, as I'm talking too much in this interview, dear Ramona. I tell them that possession by memory is a really crucial matter, and that the only way to do it is to go off by yourself quietly and read out loud to yourself again and again until it enters you. And, you know, people underestimate how important memory is for thinking of any kind. I mean, we all try to live in democracies. I greatly fear that the United States increasingly is not a democracy. It shows every sign of becoming an oligarchy, a plutocracy, and alas, a theocracy. The Tea Party fascists are enveloping us, and I really fear for the future of this nation, in which case I fear for the future of the world. And I blame it on ignorance. I blame it on the fact that people have forgotten how to read. If you remember the best that has been written, the best that has been uttered, said, if you read the best and hold on to it, then you will think better and more clearly, because without memory there is no clear thinking, and without clear thinking there can be no democracy.
So there's such a lot that might be lost with modern technology, not just to memorize things, but the kinds of things that memorizing things leads to.
Well, what I increasingly feel, Ramona, Gertrude Stein said wonderfully, one writes for oneself and for strangers. I try not to write for anyone I actually know, including my own students, or I think I have by now 35 or 40,000 former students. After all, I'm going to be starting my 56th consecutive year of teaching full-time at Yale, and I taught for 20 years authorized moonlighting at New York University, and I've taught many times at the University of Bologna and the University of Rome in Italy and other universities abroad and here at home. One writes for oneself and for strangers. I write for the common readers, wherever they are, and I visualize them as people of all ages, but I hope particularly younger people, who really have a deep calling to read, solitary readers, I would call them, who wish to go apart and read for themselves, who are tired of the drone of the media in their ears, are tired of visual overstimulation. We live in a culture where people are forgetting how to read because between the television screen and the computer screen and the motion picture screen, reading and thinking are being drubbed out, are being pulverized, and it is a very terrible kind of thing.
Yes. I wonder what teaching young students like that, does it teach you anything, or are you only teaching them things? What do they teach you?
I wouldn't go on teaching. After all, I am 81 and my health is not as good and I'm not strong anymore. But no, I go on teaching because they educate me. One of my discussion groups or any one of them begins with my asking particular students to read a poem or a Shakespearean soliloquy or speech or passage out loud, and then for her or him to comment on what they've just read, and then I encourage the other students to get involved, and I lean back and listen to them speak to one another, and I speak only when spoken to or when I feel I might help a little with directing it, but I no longer blather at them the way I did when I was young and middle-aged or even in early old age. Now that I'm so considerably older, I want to listen to them. I want to listen to them in a way in which very gently they're guided to speak at their best, really.
You also wrote that you learned that your function is to help the reader or help the student get lost.
Yes, I think get lost, but only in a kind of tropological or metaphorical sense, Ramona. They're lost in the sense of getting away from the excessive stimuli of the media, this endless noise with which they are assaulted, asking them to go apart and read for themselves. And I really don't distinguish between the readers I seem to have all over the world, and I'm very grateful for that, whom I will never meet, though I can't handle the letters I get, I can't handle the thousands of emails. I just have to hope that they'll be patient with me and not think that I I'm not moved. I even get telephone calls from young people all over the world, in particular whom I've never met and never will meet. And at times, it's exhausting. And of course, there's also the flood of unsolicited manuscripts, which is just too much for me. I can't deal with that. I wouldn't be able to do my own work or live my own life. But I don't distinguish between these unknown readers around the world, or indeed in my own country, in whatever language that I'm translated into. I don't distinguish between them and the students I have taught in the past, or whom I will have teaching me, and I'll be teaching them this coming autumn.
You, I'm speaking with Harold Bloom here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National, Ramona Koval with you. You speak of it. It sounds lovely to be in a class with you, to be learning. But I was also surprised that you also talk about literary friendships, of course, but also enemies that you have made. How is it possible to make to be such a passionate enemy in the field of literature?
Well, I really am the pariah of my profession in the English-speaking world. I had to walk out. I resigned from the English department, where I'd been a faculty member from 1955 on. In 1976, I went to the acting president and provost of Yale, Hannah Gray, and petitioned the Yale Corporation, that is to say the trustees through her, to release me from the Department of English. And I haven't been a professor of English since then. I'm a non-department of one with the president of Yale, whoever it is at a particular time. Now it's a very splendid president, Rick Levin, as my chair. And I have no colleagues. Sometimes it's lonesome, but I'm the Sterling Professor of the Humanities, but there's no Department of the Humanities. There is a Center for the Humanities and so on. But I can't even be there anymore because the stairs are too hard for me to climb. So I'm isolated at Yale and have been for a very long time now, except in terms of my students.
What do you think the nub of the issue has been?
Well, it's been a whole series of things. Initially, it was the school of T.S. Eliot, the Yale and other new critical disciples of T.S. Eliot, a great poet, but I think a vicious and nasty literary critic and cultural polemicist, and it's not too much to say, a professional anti-Semite whom I hold in the greatest contempt, though alas, a great poet, I would reluctantly have to concede, since I think I know all of the great poetry by heart. That doesn't mean I like him. Or ever could like him. He's dead a long time now, of course. But the school of Eliot, which despised the Romantic poets, despised Walt Whitman, despised Hart Crane, denigrated Wallace Stevens, didn't feel that Blake was a poet or Shelley was a poet. I fought them tooth and nail at Yale and elsewhere. And by the time they were vanquished and all that, I had a new set of enemies, most of whom were my personal friends, the school of deconstruction, the late Paul DeMond, the late Jacques Derrida, the still living J. Hillis Miller and Jeffrey Hartman, all my good friends, and I got confused with them sometimes, but I was never a deconstructionist. Not now, not then, never would be. I didn't believe that you could reduce literature to perpetual ironies, as my friend Paul DeMond liked to say, the permanent parabasis of meaning, which he followed Friedrich Schlegel. And then when I was done battling them and they had one way or another vanished, then came the major struggle of my life. From 1968 on, the great cultural revolution swept over the entire world, born out of something very worthwhile indeed, student and humane revulsion to the horrors of the dreadful fascist American war against the Vietnamese. I wish to make something very clear. I am a lifelong democratic socialist. I am not a conservative. I'm not a cultural conservative. I'm anything but a political conservative. I loathe political conservatism and religious conservatism, but nevertheless, I do believe in cognitive and aesthetic values, and I've had to fight an endless guerrilla war now for more than 40 years against the flood tide, which is still now only beginning to subside. People who tried to convince themselves and others that skin pigmentation, sexual orientation, gender, ethnic origins were what mattered about deciding what was or what was not worth reading. I found that obscene and still do. But I have made more vitriolic enemies in that camp than any other. Mind you, authentic feminism and authentic feminist literary criticism, I not only believe in both, but I fathered feminist literary criticism, as my friends Susan Gubar and Sandra Gilbert will testify, or indeed my dear student Camille Paglia will more than testify. But what I call the feministas, whether in, I couldn't call it literary criticism, I think that so-called feminist literary criticism is like the Holy Roman Empire, neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. In the same way, feminist literary criticism is not feminist. It's not literary, and it's certainly not criticism, as is usually practiced. I'm not talking about Gilbert and Gubar. I'm not talking about Elaine Showalter and other people with minds. I'm talking about the rabblement, as I call them, the rabblement of lemmings again. But I think there's a lot of resentment of me in Australia among pseudo-Marxists, not true Groucho Marxists like myself, inheritors of Dr. Leavis's dreadful tradition and so forth.
But in many ways,
I don't want to get into these polemics. You know, I'm 81 years old and counting, and there's no point my getting involved in further polemics. You know, as the great Karl Marx, with whom I have no quarrel with Marx himself, said, "Let the dead bury the dead."
But you are seem to be the last man standing here.
Well, for now. But I, too, will go under, my dear. We will, as I say at one point, we will be mixed together in our common dust.
You are writing a memoir now, I understand.
I'm writing a book called The Hum of Thoughts Evaded in the Mind, which is a literary memoir. It won't talk about my splendid wife or my two sons or most of my friends, unless they're literary friends, but it will. On the model of Wordsworth's The Prelude, which certainly sounds very pretentious, and I don't mean to be pretentious. I am not William Wordsworth, nor was meant to be. I'm merely an exegete. But the growth of a critic's mind, you might call it. And it will involve a lot of people who have meant a great deal to me as human beings. The wonderful late English novelist and general roustabout Anthony Burgess, whom I miss almost every day. And George Wilson Knight, G. Wilson Knight, who meant a great deal to me personally, a wonderful critic of Shakespeare and of the Romantic poets, and Kenneth Burke, who really became my true critical mentor or father. I miss Kenneth very much. He died at a vast old age when he was 97 or so, some years ago. So I will talk about my relation to them and others, and of course all the poets I have been close to, and the novelists and the dramatists and fellow critics and so on.
In your book, you ask yourself questions like, what is the end of a literary life? And you talk about this book being your swan song, this book, The Anatomy of Influence.
What's a swan song in terms of the whole subject that has obsessed me long before I even wrote the first draft of The Anatomy of Influence in the summer of 1967? In a sense, it's obsessed me since I was a little child. But that's over now. I don't think after this book I have anything more to say about what I now would call literary love tempered by ambivalence, which is my final definition of what I used to call the anxiety of influence.
Love tempered by ambivalence. It seems a contradiction.
Think of the fact that, Ramona, all of us, we love our husbands and wives, or depending on our sexual orientation, our partners of one kind or another. We love our parents and our relatives and our close friends and our own children and grandchildren. And it didn't take Freud to teach us that. Shakespeare, who precedes Freud in every respect, teaches us that. There's always an ambivalent underflow. You make so heavy, as Freud says, a Bizet song, an investment in others, that some element in your own ego, your own deep self, rebels against it, and you have to watch that. And I think that is the phenomenon that is involved in the influence process. People cannot become poets, or indeed strong writers, novelists, critics, essayists, dramatists, story writers, unless they first fall in love with great precursor figures who can be contemporary with them, in fact. But as they develop, they have to find their own space by trying to see what the distance and difference might be, which makes their own work necessary and justified.
Well, Harold Bloom, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you today.
I'm sorry that it's over. I have this infinite regret. I love Australian poetry from Judith Wright and Alec Hope on through our great contemporaries, Les Murray and John Kinsler, among others. There are many more. Indeed, I'm haunted by the wonderful Australian communist poet John Manifold, poet of World War II, I suppose. He must be dead many years now, but I remember loving his poetry when I was a little boy. I can never get out of my head a wonderful little poem that he wrote called Fife Tune, when he and his Australian brigade were going off to fight in Western Europe. Do you know the poem? It's a lovely poem.
I don't.
One morning in spring, we marched from devices, all shapes and all sizes, like beads on a string. But yet with a swing, we trod the blue metal, and full of high fettle, we started to sing. She ran down the stairs, a 12-year-old darling, and laughing and calling and tossing her bright hair, then silent to stare at the men flowing past her. They were all she could master, adoring her there. It's seldom I've seen a gentler or prettier. I doubt we'll forget her in 2 years or three, and lucky he'll be whom she takes for a lover when we are far over the treacherous sea.
Oh, wow.
More contemporary Australians knew John Manifold, but he was a communist, a rather fierce communist, but a fighting communist and an anti-fascist, and not a great poet. You can hear the influence of E.E. Housman on him even in that poem, but
yes.
A very fine poet. Well, bless you, Ramona. I'm sorry this is over.
Harold Bloom, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for bringing us John Manifold back again and in such a fantastic way.
And congratulations, my dear, on your latest grandchild.
Grandchildren, yes, twins. Thank you, Harold.
Oh, I didn't know they were twins. Two boys?
One of each.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. Well, bless you, Ramona. Goodbye, my dearest. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Harold. Thank you so much. And The Anatomy of Influence, Literature as a Way of Life, is published by Yale University Press.